Chapter 551 of the Government Code. There is a quorum with 11 members present. Normally, we would excuse an absence if it is a commission member that can't attend the meeting. So we have a little bit of a technically unusual event this morning in that we did not fire the Department of Banking Commissioner. He is not gone because he's spending more time with his family. But he is doing some very important work in Washington, D.C. right now. Charles had an opportunity to attend some meetings in the Trump administration. And so he is meeting with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and meeting with Trump's Economic Advisory Committee, which is a consortium of six states. And we greatly appreciate the opportunity to have some input at that level. He did ask me for permission to miss his first Finance Commission meeting, of which, of course, I granted. And if the commission sees it fit that you want to do something formal and excuse his absence for the record, I'm happy to do that. If not, just want you to know why he's not sitting at the table. Stephanie has volunteered to be up here today. Bob is here as well. Both are very ably capable of handling things in his absence, but just wanted you to know where Charles is and what he's doing. Moving
Madam
on to the
finance. Yes. Comment on that. You know, we have the Finance Commission has encouraged the agency heads and their staffs to participate in these national organizations and to go where they need to go in order to make sure that the state of Texas is represented in our ideas as a large state with a large population, make sure our ideas are presented. So that's a good thing. I just want to thank each agency head for the ethical and professional way they do the travel with the recent unpleasantness at the Liquor Control Board and
Alcoholic Beverage Commission.
That, you know, that's never been a concern with our agencies, and you know, I think they're doing what we've asked them to, and I appreciate the way they do it.
Thank you. Okay, Finance Commission matters. Before we dive into the consent, just a few quick comments. Firstly, to remind the members that this is PFS time, so your personal financial statements are due by the end of April. You do have an opportunity, if you need to file for an extension. Now that's done automated, you have to log into the system and file for it, and the nice thing is it's immediately granted and you get an email. And that extension would take you to June 30th if need be. Please, I encourage you to either file timely or get your extension, because you will be hit with fines and penalties if you do not. So please don't forget, stick that on your Outlook calendar.
And if you haven't signed up yet?
Yes, you're going to need a login.
It's not easy.
No, it is not.
It takes a couple of days. So.
You need to give yourself some lead time.
They have gotten automated, but there's still a lot of upward movement to be made. Secondly, you've been seeing the legislative updates every Monday. I realize this fills a lot of paperwork in your email boxes. They are lengthy. We're at a point in the session where we're at 38 days, are we? 38
yes.
days, okay. And so we're sort of at the stage where obviously can't file a new bill any longer. Bills are at committee hearings, and some are coming out of committee and going to the floor and getting calendared. And certainly we are following a myriad of bills. Quite a few of them are impactful to us. I want to thank all three of the commissioners and their agency staff, because this is an extremely active time for them. They are testifying nonstop, providing resource information, witnesses, supporting, you know, the initiatives that we need, defending initiatives that might not necessarily be favorable to the agencies. And it is a very active time. So they have a lot on their plate right now. And I really appreciate all their efforts there. Other than that, we'll move on. The consent calendar, or the minutes, which were on consent. As far as public comment, we don't have any witness cards, and we don't, I'm assuming we don't. Okay, so in that case, if there is anyone wishing to fill out a witness card and address the commission, please fill out the form and just bring it up front. And with that, the consent agenda was on page 17. Members, before we take up the consent agenda item A1 in a single vote, I just want to state that you can always request at any time to remove an item from the consent agenda and put it on the regular agenda so that we can discuss it and vote on it individually. And assuming that we don't have that in this case, hearing no objections from any members, do I hear a motion to adopt the consent agenda item A1 without discussion?
So moved.
Thank you, Jay, and thank you in the corner. Thank you, Hector. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion passes. We'll move on to Finance Commission operations.
Okay, first of all, today is San Jacinto Day, so happy San Jacinto Day, just in case you're...
Outlook doesn't have that on the calendar.
I didn't have that on your calendar. I thought we might recognize that. And then Chair London mentioned the legislative activity certainly is continuing at a rapid pace, and today is indeed the 102nd day of the 140-day session. So beginning in about 2 weeks, we start hitting some pretty major hurdles for legislation, deadlines that bills have to clear or they no longer remain viable. And so that we'll start seeing... the effects of that very, very, very quickly. Each of the agencies is obviously going to discuss their individual legislative issues within their agency reports, but there are certainly a number of bills which we may not discuss that affect all three agencies in the area of, like, rulemaking. We'll have, there's some substantial proposals out there related to rulemaking, which would affect the Finance Commission. Cybersecurity, which is going to affect all the agencies. There are a few bills on contracting still. Even after last session, there'll be a few more. Some bills on public information and some bills on occupational licensing, again, that may potentially affect all of us. So we'll update you on those bills in June when we know which will become law. There's so many measures. I mean, we're monitoring them all, but it's kind of hard to see which ones are emerging right now as the leaders. But anyway, certainly several of those. I know there was one bill we wanted to mention, Senate Bill 1875. Caroline, did you want to report on that?
Thank you, Leslie. SB 1875, filed by Senator Hinojosa, is the SDSI bill that would provide for procedures to become SDSI, reporting while SDSI, and the procedure for revoking that SDSI status. It would add some additional reporting requirements for the three financial commission agencies. The bill was received in the House yesterday. And so that's its status. Of course, we're all three monitoring it, and we'll comply with however it is enacted, if it is enacted.
So that means it passed on the Senate's local calendar the day before yesterday, and then has now gone over
was received
to the House.
In the House.
Is it onerous?
It has a number of reporting requirements. It certainly extends the reporting requirements beyond a time period that we have not been responsible for reporting, and it's a longer time period than I think other agencies report. It would require five years of data with every annual report that we file. But that's other than that, and there's some new performance measures that we would have to report on a regular basis, so there's some different reporting requirements. And then I think we just are trying to understand the impact of some of the additional language. The primary purpose, I think, of the bill is to create a new system for agencies who want to become SDSI, and so that it creates those opportunities.
That's some formal procedure. Consistent, uniform procedure.
It also adds a requirement for the state auditor's office to do the SDSI audits. The current law just says they will perform the audits, and this bill makes it be at least once every 6 years that they would come in and do an SDSI audit.
It also gives the LBB a little bit more power and authority than we might prefer. And I think the goal was certainly to raise the bar for those who don't already have it, but it sort of drags us in somewhat where we probably not like to be.
In the budget process?
No, not the budget process.
It sort of politicizes SDSI a little bit.
It's just some oversight kind of authority. But we'll keep you posted.
The only one I'll also add that there's quite a few bills that are in the Public Funds Investment Act, and so we all will probably have to update our investment policies in August when we find out what all passes.
Absolutely.
There.
A lot of those are just changing the permissible investments. Mm-hmm. So. Okay, and I think that's really all we have in terms of operations at this point.
Would you mention an update, one of you, on the home equity bills process, the two joint resolutions?
Certainly. I mean, we've had on the HJRs, they've had hearings on both bills. They were actually, I believe, on the same day. And I believe both of those bills have been voted from committee. HJR 99, and in the House, it was reported from the committee as substituted on April 17th. And so that presumably is headed to the calendars committee. And then the Senate companion
passed yesterday.
Okay.
Great. So in particular for that bill, and I can't off the top of my head remember the joint resolution numbers, but that's a particularly impactful piece of legislation that we're watching. It's been a consortium of support to see that getting to where it is. So the way that home equity works for the newer members at the commission, home equity is a constitutional amendment. And so in particular in this bill, there's been a lot of need to retool and sort of update that law, and this has a couple of provisions that would be extremely helpful to consumers. In particular, the way home equity currently is administered, there is a 3% cap on closing costs and fees. And what that does, in essence, is it locks out of the market lower loan amounts. Anything below about $140,000 is very difficult for a consumer to go out and get a home equity loan and be able to honor that cap. And so this really assists in redistributing how the cap works and restructuring it. The other thing it does is home equity loans in Texas have a little bit of a stigma. Once a home equity, always a home equity for title purposes. And so this would potentially change that as well. Trying to think of anything else.
Yeah, allow a refinance after a year.
Yes, a season loan after a year would be a regular refinance, which means lower rates to the consumer. So all of the prospective changes in this would have very positive consumer impact in the marketplace. If these pass, they still would be up for constitutional vote.
Right.
But
yeah, and it
that
passed,
said,
it passed 30-0 yesterday. The Senate version did.
This isn't an issue that the legislature tackles very often because it is a very difficult issue. So it's hoping this one has some legs.
One other item that Commissioner Cooper asked me to mention was the sunset process, that we may actually be in the sunset process before y'all's next meeting. If it follows the track that we anticipate it will follow, it will start in early June. And I think it's probably almost a year-long process that we will go through. I think they will be interviewing all of you, and you'll be involved in the sunset evaluation as well.
And again, why don't you give a quick explanation for the newer members of the commission exactly what sunset is so they understand?
I'm not even sure I completely understand, but you go, the law mandates that each agency go through a sunset review to make sure that you should stay in existence, that you still have a purpose, that you're meeting the mandates of this statute. And so I think the evaluation focuses on that. Our last sunset evaluation was done 18 years ago, and so there's lots of work that we will have to do over the summer. If the schedule follows like it did last session, our reports will be due September 1st, and it's almost like a self-evaluation in a sense, but it's a substantial amount of paperwork that we have to fill out for each of the divisions and each of the areas that we regulate.
And I would say each of our statutes have an expiration clause that we have to be reenacted by the legislature, and so this is the precursor to that process for the legislature to have a bill to recreate or extend our agencies to a new term.
I have some experience with sunset with another department. Do you sense that there's any agenda out there that you're concerned with?
I don't, and we've been put off so many times. I think it's just they can't put us off any longer. We have
They have a, they call a safety net bill, a scheduling bill, where they reschedule agencies every session to amend their workload to make sure it's it fits within the resources they have available. And that bill was heard this week, and we were not listed as an agency at the time that they would extend. So we've been
extended. And the one 18 years ago went pretty smoothly.
Yes.
Well,
I'm going to say sunset. Sunset, you say it like it's an audit, but it's
It's a lot more than an audit.
It's way more than that.
I mean, it will consume our lives for 6 to 8 months.
It is fraught with the possibility of mischief.
Yes. Absolutely.
It is a process with a lot of hands in the process.
So when you said that there were interviews, are you saying that the commission members
will be? Yeah.
So are we going to plan on having some sort of a education, if you will, prior to this, so that, I mean, I remember being called on to support the Savings and Loan Department years ago when they went through this process. And so it would be good, I think, especially for new members, that everybody understands what the history is, what, you know, what other states do and how everything works and how we're funded, blah, blah, blah.
Why Stephanie and Charles had her mention it is because we weren't thinking that we were going to be dealing with it right now, and now it's looking like we might be dealing with it a little earlier than we planned. So yes, we will have a briefing and we will cover it so that everybody's clear on what's involved and we don't have to digress there today and understand what our responsibilities are.
And I would say, yeah, the first step is going to be the agencies beginning their self-evaluation reports, which will take from June through August. So that's step one.
Do we know who's going to be on the advisory commission?
We know maybe half of the members, we believe, but they will have some new members by the time we go through the process.
Are those all legislators?
There are four from the House, four from the Senate, and then there's a public member on each side, one from the House, that they, the Speaker or the Lieutenant Governor name.
Okay. Got it.
Okay.
Sorry. Caroline, did you have anything else that you wanted to add on?
Not under the General Finance Commission.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Then in that case, we'll move on to the Audit Committee report.
Okay, the Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's February 28, 2017 Investment Officer Report.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion's adopted.
Secondly, the Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2017 second quarter financial statements.
Coming upon recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion's adopted. Okay. Discussion of and possible vote to take action on the Finance Commission Agency Heads Fiscal Year 2017 Midterm Accomplishment Reports.
And Madam Chair, I'm not sure what your pleasure is on these. The Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner report is listed on page 19 through 26. It's up to the chair. I know sometimes you've had us hit some highlights, and sometimes because y'all have already reviewed them and we cover a lot of these issues during the individual agency reports, we've chosen to just have the written reports.
And everybody was here for the Audit Committee meeting, which was helpful. So unless any specific questions are at hand, I would say let's move on, but please stop. I don't want to not give anybody an opportunity to ask a question if they have one. Okay, assuming that, do I hear a motion to approve the Finance Commission Agency Head Fiscal Year 2017 Midterm Accomplishment Reports?
So moved.
Will? Molly? Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion's adopted. That takes us to the agenda item on the report on the financial condition of the state banking system. You have a separate, lovely bound document that our gratitude goes to Wendy Rodriguez for creating this document. A tremendous amount of work goes into this. Little Birdie has told me that in particular for this publication, she didn't have the same level of help that she usually does, and so she did a lot of extra work, which we appreciate, and this has information from both Savings and Mortgage Lending and the Department of Banking. I encourage you all to read this. It is distributed widely as a resource. It's a wonderful publication. Did you want to add any commentary on it?
Unless anyone has any questions.
It looks real pretty.
In addition to looking really pretty, it has a really, it's a wealth of information in a very concise format that you would spend hours researching if you were trying to get this information in a variety of sources, and I'm sure Wendy spends quite a bit more than a few hours in trying to pull it together. So we appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, agenda items 8, 9, and 10, personnel matters, facility, and attorney consultations. We'll all move to executive session. And with that, Leslie will move to Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. Our report begins on page 42. And on page 2 here, just a second. Okay, so first, we began with the report on consumer protection and consumer assistance on page 42, and you see the normal types of information that we're reporting to you with at each meeting. You'll see on our examination activity where the year-over-year comparison for the six-month period of each fiscal year, 16 and 17. We do expect to meet all of our exam category type goals for fiscal year 17. I know it shows we're pretty far ahead of motor vehicle sales finance, and we're still in credit access businesses, and we're a little bit behind on the other two, but we expect those to work out. Our overall targets by mid-year, we are at 54% of our targeted goal at mid-year, so things are going well. Much credit to Rudy and his team for keeping the trains on track and keeping the production working. I think we've made some good efforts that I think have helped us with some turnover issues that have helped us keep the production up on examinations. It's been very valuable. On page 43, you see information related to our acceptable level of compliance, which again we continue to work on. We see much better performance at this point in time from a couple of the groups, property tax lending and motor vehicle sales finance, both over 80% or higher. So we appreciate the work of the respective industries towards keeping that level of compliance moving in the right direction, and we're very proud of that, pleased with that performance. At the bottom of page 43 gives you the trailing 12 months of compliance rates, and so we still see that's a little bit, we've got a couple of areas I'd say that's still kind of trailing behind, and I'm sorry, but apparently when we scanned the material or something, we dropped the legend on two of the lines, and so the triangle number down there is the credit access businesses, and the number at 91% associated with the squares is property tax lenders. So those are for some reason those got cut off the bottom of the page, but again, I think we see progress in the right direction on the trailing 12 months. On page 44 is information on investigations and complaints processed, and we're seeing a pretty good dip in activity in investigations and in complaints processed. And while the respective areas in which we see activity still remain fairly consistent, for example, motor vehicle sales finance continues to remain high, it's a little soon to know. Sometimes the economy starts looking good, and we do see these dips off in investigations and complaints. Things stabilize a little bit. They may jump back up, but we'll continue. We've really been working hard and believe that, you know, we've cleared out some very old investigations, so we've used this time wisely and continue to work and get some of the older activity off the books. So that's positive. And page 45 is just the breakdown of your top complaint areas. We continue to report, and again, for motor vehicle sales finance is 55% of what we're working on in terms of complaints. Still continues to be high. Page 47 is information on credit access businesses, and you'll see the comparison of the calendar year 2015 and 2016 data. So this is your first reporting of 2016 calendar data. The data continues, the trends continue to show what we've been experiencing for quite some time, as there's continues to be movement into the multiple installment products. And you see year-over-year increases in the multiple installment category from 2015 to 2016. And then you see declines in the single installment category. So overall, you see the number of new loans have declined by approximately 5%, and those single payment products are leading that decline. But as you would, you know, logically see that multiple installment products with a longer term, those tend to cover the same period of time, and that sort of offsets a little bit of that. But overall, you still see that decline.
May I ask a question?
Certainly.
All right, so if we're looking at the chart, payday loans, next to the last line of that section is average fee per $100 borrowed on planned term.
Yes.
2016, 2376. So if I'm reading that correctly, there's a fee of 24%?
For every $100 borrowed on the planned term, the average fee being charged was $23.76 for each $100.
And that's a fee charged to the end user, to the consumer?
Yes.
And that's outside of interest?
Yes. But the interest, remember, is that simple interest of 10% or less. So that's not, I mean, that's pretty
small. So if I borrow $400, I had $100 in fees roughly?
Yes, that's correct. And an average term of 19 days.
And then if I go to multiple installments, help me, how me translate that?
Let me ask one of the folks from Consumer Protection, either Rudy or William, to come talk about that line item on the data.
Rudy Aguilar, Director of Examination and Enforcement Group. William Purse is our senior examiner. So in the multiple installment, you can see that the original term that is 160 days in for that time period. So it's a longer total term, so the fee is going to be higher in that situation normally.
So for the 160 days, there was a total of $168 charged in fees per $100?
Yes, this is William Perch, Senior Review Examiner. So if you break it down, the total charge in 2015 was $540. That would be the cumulative dollar amount.
But if you break
it down per 100, it would have been a $166 or $165 for the year 2015 and 16, respectively.
Yeah, well, break it down to me. I'm an individual, and I borrowed $100.
Okay.
And I borrowed, or whatever amount you want to use, and I borrowed it for 159 days. I paid $165 in fees on top of the 10%. Is that correct?
Right, per $100. So the total fee will be higher, but if you break it down per 100, you would pay in 2016 about $166 per 100.
So that's... Go ahead.
The term of 159 days.
So is there any regulation as to how much fees they can charge?
No.
No.
Why not?
The authorization is for a credit service organization to be able to charge a fee to provide the services of improving someone's credit or helping them secure an extension of credit, and classifies that as a fee and does not cap it.
So I'm asking this in general. How do we feel good about that? You know, how do we feel like we're protecting the consumer at these type of fees? And I know there's a thing about, well, the banks don't want to loan it, blah, 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 but this just seems crazy, and I'm new, so this is new stuff to me.
So our obligation is to administer the law as the policy is handed down from the legislature. And the legislature has spent a lot of time on credit access business issues over the years. In 2009, they made some, 2011, I guess, they made some significant decisions related to credit access businesses. They did not choose to put in some of the provisions that might have regulated more of the product itself. They chose to focus on licensing and reporting. They've continued to consider bills that might address some of the product characteristics. And in fact, next Tuesday is kind of payday lending day in the House Investments and Financial Services Committee. There are a number of bills that the legislature will consider that may address some of the product limitations or restrictions. But that's our responsibility, is related to reporting this data so that policymakers have it to make decisions with. And that's what we're responsible for.
And when this transaction scenario originally began to be developed and used, there was original litigation about the interpretation of the statute, and the industry view of it was upheld.
I have a question just for illumination, and I've been here just long enough that I kind of know the answer, but I'm not sure I know it. I think we track how many of these loans effectively are evergreen, right? They don't actually pay them off, they keep renewing them.
We have some data on how, when loans are paid off, and the number, when a loan is paid off, the number of times that it had been renewed, yep. And so that's, we have some data on
so
that.
So here's my question on that, because I'm not really clear on it. If they're paying $166 per 100 per 159 days, if they continually renew, does that mean that on the initial 100 they borrow, they're effectively paying 300 and some odd dollars a year, close to 400? Do they repay the same fee when they re-up? Yeah. I think they do, yeah. Right?
Well, yeah.
So the annual fee is more like, if you were to renew your loan, your annual fee is about $330, $40 on $100.
There's a contract that exists at the time the transaction is entered into.
I get that.
That goes ahead and stipulates how the credit service organization fee is earned and applied,
right.
And that can affect that. But it can result, just as you have expressed,
yeah,
that only the fee gets paid.
I know we don't control the law regarding what people pay. That's by statute. I totally understand it. I was just trying to understand the process to see how it works, because I'm relatively, I have a pretty good sense of it, because I've got several hundred employees who probably all have paid a loan.
In our exams, yeah. We look at those contracts that are in place and try to assure that those payments are being applied per the contract.
The statute.
The contract. There's a specific contract that's entered into by the CSO agreement and the consumer.
Right. And you're also making sure that the contracts meet the statute,
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So, Rudy, when you have a contract, there are really three parties to the contract. Is that right?
There's three parties to the transaction. The borrower, the credit service organization, what is normally the storefront, and the lender. So borrower, lender, and the credit service organization that is the storefront.
So there is a contract between the
CSO and the borrower.
Say that again.
The contract that I'm talking about in my discussion was the contract between the CSO and the borrower,
and
or their customer.
There's another contract, right?
There is another agreement between the true lender and the CSO.
Okay. So what happens when, if a borrower is unable to close out the loan at the end of its term, and it has to be renewed? Does the contract, let's first talk about the contract with the credit service organization. Does that contract contemplate a renewal, and what the fees will be with respect to that renewal?
Not always. They're viewed as the initiation of a new transaction, a new relationship.
Okay, so it starts over with a new contract.
Yes.
Okay.
Normally the same one, but
okay, so now let's talk about the contract with the lender. So if the lender has a contract, and it probably has a stated interest rate of 10% per annum or something like that. Most likely it's whatever the usury cap, statutory usury cap is. If the loan is not repaid at that time, what happens with that contract? Does that contract expire, or does it continue on?
In my recollection, I think most of those contracts address that relationship in general, and not, you know, loan by loan.
Well, let me ask you this. So is there a fee that under the lender contract with the consumer, is there a fee charged in addition to the interest rate for failure to pay the loan when it comes due?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, that's the loan note that we're talking there, and essentially loan notes normally set up on a true daily earnings, basis for the accrual of finance charge or interest.
To your knowledge, there's no fee in addition to the interest rate payment?
Well, there would be a late charge that could be possibly owed,
okay.
That would be limited at 5% of the scheduled payment, or $7.50 after 10 days, after it's due. But outside of the third-party lender's interest and the late charge, there would be no other additional fees that would be paid to the lender themselves for for the.
Did you say that fee was per 100, or is that the total?
It's a fee set by statute.
Okay.
And it's set to be 5% of the scheduled payment that's due after 10 days after the date's due, or $7.50, whichever is higher. But it's a late charge.
So that goes to the whole issue of answering Vince's question directly. How do people feel good about it? There's a huge risk for the CSO, right?
Although we have seen some late charges, it's normally addressed before you get to that point and a renewal is.
Right. I get that. But that's the answer is those guys with the storefront are charging those fees because they have a high failure rate.
Right, there's the high risk.
But all the fees are always posted in every branch operating under the Truth and Lending Office too.
Yes, yes. And that's part of the statute relates to disclosure and some of those kinds of things.
That opens up a whole other discussion that Vince and I are both probably sensitive to because of the nature of our employees. I mean, they may be there, but because of their particular circumstance in their life, they need the money because they got to put a tire on their car, or they have to get to work and so on. And the fees are less important than the actuality of having to fix their car.
And I think the number that we're looking at is an average. You're going to have a lot of lenders that will be far below that, and then some that will be above that. But the marketplace will dictate the competitive situation, so the consumer can shop around.
Yes.
Yeah, Vince, you asked the question and whether these rates are price regulated or not. And we do have some products, not like this, but we have regulated rates. But that's not this product.
That's not this product.
This product is the legislature, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Leslie, but the legislature's general view was we'll let competition set the price for these and we'll not have it price regulated by an agency. And I have not done this recently, but I've done it maybe a year ago. If you go actually look at the websites of payday lenders, you will find the prices vary widely. The fee charged by the credit assets business varies widely. So there is competition for the price. And if you price compare, you can find a lower price.
Yeah, and I think the reality, though, is, and again, what do I know about that reality? I really don't. Is if you're in that situation, you're not price shopping, you're just trying to get the money this week, tomorrow, today, because I got to buy the tire in order to get to work, get my next paycheck. You know, and I think about, and again, so this is probably, this may be out of our purview. You basically said it's our job to execute the laws.
Yep.
But in our mission statement, we do talk about the economic prosperity of Texas. And the economic prosperity of Texas is in its citizens. I can't believe I'm saying that because I own a business. I know that I'm prosperous, then everyone else is prosperous, right? But anyway, it just seems, and again, I realize this can't go anywhere here. These fees just seem outrageous. They seem that it's going to keep this group of people. How do you ever get out from underneath that? Put yourself in that position and think, how do I ever get out from underneath that? I've never been in that situation, but and actually my employees are higher paid, and so hopefully none of them are in that situation. But it just seems like an endless circle we tend to put these people in, because I personally believe debt is the worst thing that anybody can have.
Vince, I understand your concern, but one of the things I would express is that in the disclosures that are required, the cost of different options is expressed in that disclosure to the consumer. You know,
when you buy a car, do you actually read the whole document?
No, sir. And
and that's our responsibility.
Well, he does, and I do, but probably
we speak to consumers all the time.
I do.
Wait, for the record, you're involved in writing that document.
Yeah. We speak to consumers all the time that can have remorse as quickly as a few hours after they buy a car or make a loan and start talking to us about what they can do, and we try to counsel them, or and if we can, you know, help them get something undone that day. If it's quick enough, we'll try, but we can't.
Please know my statements aren't pointed at our agency as much as just an expression of concern. So.
And I just didn't want the moment to go by without also mentioning that the balance that was also considered at the time that this legislation was adopted and that the system was created, not only are we dealing with disclosure, but there was also a heavy emphasis on the financial capability and education, and that's why we have the Financial Education Endowment Fund, and that's why we're working on helping to promote an economic prosperity among Texans and helping to support some of those projects, some of those organizations and the education of consumers.
So maybe those, we you think down the road that these type of organizations are loaning this money, maybe you're required to hand out a flyer saying, here's where you can go get education on this. So we actually are educating the people that are needing it. I don't know how we get to those people otherwise.
But some of the disclosure that we provide has resources for financial education.
So Leslie, at the break, could you get that, you know, there's that disclosure, which is sort of the one pager, which has the picture on it.
Yep.
If you could distribute that, I mean, that,
okay.
While it's not, you know, it's a significant contract, but there also is a disclosure event. So there's also a disclosure that I think if you see the picture, it at least shows you what we've tried to do to make it as easy as possible for consumers to understand what they're getting into.
So. We, of course, work within, you know, the parameters of the law. That's all we can do. I did want to mention just that the CFPB has a pending proposal, and that's a very significant federal mandate. And
CFPB?
Yes, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Okay. And that will be a significant game changer for the industry, and they're getting prepared for it as we speak, but that is out there.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you. So just a few more comments on our activities. On page 49 is our dashboard on licensing activity, and I'm just looking at the chart on the bottom right with it. This is the composite of all regulated entities, and it's still holding up fairly at a fairly high level, one of our highest levels yet. So we're showing some signs of a little bit of slowdown, but stabilization of our market. We may see a little bit of dip as we get through another renewal cycle, but that's still holding in there. On page 50, I just wanted to draw your attention to some information on some website analytics, and certainly we see a pretty active presence with our web page, but as we're talking about consumers receiving resource information, the top 10 searches on our website, our consumer resources web page was identified, and that's increased by about 6.5% from the prior year. We have formulated an internal website committee that's working on redeveloping some of our refresh and some update of the content on our website. On page 52, there's a report on our consumer education staff and some of the work that they've been doing on providing financial education, but I just wanted to note that we've scheduled about 11 more consumer presentations throughout the end of the fiscal year, so those will be helpful in us sort of maintaining a little bit of I know we're not big and broad as some of these other organizations, but we still like to reach out and have some face-to-face contact to make sure that we still have a finger on the pulse of a number of issues that are important to consumers now, and this is one of the ways in which we continue to do that. On page 53 is a report on, I just wanted to highlight on our information technology, our legacy modernization. While I reported about that related to the budget, we are nearing the conclusion of that project with all of our deliverables being very close to being launched. We've actually launched everything with the exception of our very last module. So all of our examinations are now being completed, scheduled and completed using the online tool. And then our legal module has gone live. And so we have one last module that we'll expect to go live, we hope, by the end of the month. And then we'll move into maintenance. But again, there's a lot of growing pains as you launch some of these large IT projects. But so far, I'm really proud of the work of the staff and continue to push forward on these issues. But I think we've really begun to realize some of the old work we've done and all the efficiencies that we gain and the access to information and the collaboration and the technology environment. I think those are really paying benefits. So we'll begin to see that in the other areas of the agency too. And then at the bottom of page 53, we talked about our new security policy and compliance committee that's been formulated to work on a number of our security issues to help oversee our security posture and improve our security posture. That group has finalized our two-year roadmap to make sure that our posture is in accordance with the NIST standards, National Institute of Science and Technology standards, and our Texas Administrative Code TAC 202 standards. And so we certainly are looking at those. We've already adopted a number of new IT policies and really kind of hitting some of those short-term goals off of our roadmap. So that's positive in that regard. just wanted to highlight on, I guess, our performance measures. You'll see information on page 54 and 55. As we looked at monies returned to consumers on page 54, at the end of the second quarter, we're at about $7.6 million, 7.7 roughly this fiscal year thus far. And I will note that our percentage of written complaints closed within 90 days is at 89.4%. Our target's 90%, so we're very close within striking distance of staying on top of closing those consumer complaints. On the performance measures on page 55, we're on target with everything except those consumers receiving financial education. I mentioned those are scheduled for the summer. And then on the legal report on page 59, just there's an update on a couple of cases that we've been reporting to you over time, and I'll certainly have the legal staffs able to answer any questions on those. I did want to mention on the bottom of page 59, the PHH Corporation versus CFPB that we've also been reporting to you. It's been a little bit of development. I think at the last meeting I reported to you that the D.C. Circuit had granted the petition to the CFPB's petition to hear the case en banc. The parties have filed all their briefs on the rehearing, and on March the 10th, the attorney generals of 15 states, including Texas, did file an amicus brief in support of PHH. So that case is currently pending, and we'll continue to monitor activities on that case, but we certainly want to make you aware of that. And then on page 60, we just have reported...
Leslie, yeah. Perhaps this is a question for Matt.
I'm sure it is.
Matt, in a distant lifetime, I used to be a general counsel in a company, and I always sort of watched how many lawyers I had working on cases. And I noticed at the bottom of this, we enjoy representation by three separate divisions of the AG's office. And I wondered what the thought process is for having three separate divisions.
Good morning. Matt Nance, Deputy General Counsel, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. So this is in the Rowell versus Pettijohn case that was a case that started out in district court. And initially, we were just represented by the Financial Litigation Division. That's the division of the AG's office that would normally defend us and lawsuits against the agency regarding financial matters. So initially, we were just represented by that one division. We had two attorneys. The case got appealed to the Fifth Circuit. So then we added another division, the Solicitor General's office, the division that specializes in appellate cases. And so we kind of got a new attorney at that point. We have one Solicitor General's office attorney and two financial lit attorneys. One of the two financial lit attorneys transferred to the General Litigation Division, but continues to represent us. Should there be a need for additional trial representation? But, you know, for most of the appeal, our primary attorney has been one attorney with the Solicitor General's office.
Okay, thank you.
Then on page 60, I was just going to report, as we normally do, scholarships that the agency had received for the NMLS ESER conference, and those were on two scholarships that we received. Those are on the bottom of page 60. And with that, I guess legislatively, I forgot to mention a couple of things on our legislative issues, but Senate Bill 560 is the bill that contains the credit card surcharge administration or enforcement activity moving from our agency to the Office of the Attorney General's. That bill, the Senate bill, passed the Senate this week, and then the House companion version of that bill passed the House yesterday. So we've got the bills going in both directions, but I feel confident that that bill seems to have wide support, and I think we'll be in positive outcome on that particular piece of legislation, barring any unforeseen issues. And then, of course, we've been sending you the reports on a weekly basis. There are a number of issues that may interest the commission, and I'm happy to answer any questions, or the staff. We can answer any questions on those bills, but I won't take any more time unless there's specific questions.
I just wanted to comment on two things. Firstly, on page 43, for the newer members of the commission, the acceptable level of compliance chart that you're seeing here is something that we see regularly, and over the course of time, the numbers have been lower. And so I just really want to commend you, because these are like some of the best numbers we've seen in a very long time, and we've had immense discussion on this topic.
Yes.
And so this is really progress, and it's a really good chart.
Thank you.
And then on page 52, I noticed you mentioned that the agency did active shooter training, which
yes.
I recently just did with Homeland Security in Houston, and I'm just interested if the other two agencies have also done that, and if not, would encourage y'all to do it.
And we're plan. We are going to do that. We have, excuse me, we have not yet, but it is, we are scheduling to do that. Yes.
We've already done it.
Okay, yeah. Great. All right. So with that, this seems like an ideal time to take a break between agencies. And so with that, I now reconvene this meeting of the Finance Commission pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. The time is 10:12. With that, we will move on to the Department of Banking.
Thank you. Bob's going to start out and talk about all the memos for bank and trust and the corporate activities.
Okay, good morning. This is Mike. Bob Bacon, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Banking. Before I get into, there's one item that I want to bring up before I get into the memos. It's on a more national level, but some of you may have information or read about it, but about 3 months ago, maybe a little bit longer, the Comptroller of Currency in Washington issued a white paper regarding their issuing a charter for non-bank entities. And mainly it's for fintech-type entities that would be offered. And they went through an elaborate process of why they thought it was justified and how they would regulate them. Well, the CSBS over the last probably couple of months since that came out, and it culminated last week when they issued a letter opposing the OC's point of view. And it's if you haven't read their letter, it's really, really good. I mean, they spent a lot of time, they've done their research, they countered the authority that the OCC really doesn't have the authority, that the Congress, if they intended it, should have granted it. And then I think particularly important was the fact that there's no scheme of regulation that's been publicly approved, regulatorily approved. It would all be done by agreement. And so there's a lack of transparency, can create unlevel playing field for the other industry. I mean, so it's a real good letter of opposition. I don't know how much traction. You know, I don't know that the OCC is going to pay any attention to it. They haven't so far in a lot of stuff that CSBS has done. But all the states, you know, have gone through that. We've read it and support it. And so it's something that, it's going to be a fight that's going to happen probably in the next few months as this thing comes around. As far as the department, real quickly, starts on page 64. It's the Bank and Trust memo from Kirk Perdoms, the director. The information, you know, we go through it every time, but under the composite ratings, where you see down there the 3, 4, and 5 rated institutions, those are the ones we consider a problem. The number still is at 12. That was as of the end of February. There's been a little bit of change. The total number now is 14. We've had a couple of them improved and got off of it. And then we had one improved get off, and we had three that went downhill. And so we're up to 14 now. Kurt does the forecast. We've been looking at this a long time, so we're right at the 4.95% range. That's really about normal. There's nothing here, and we'll go to it in a minute when we get to the oil and look at some of the oil and gas information. But it's nothing we're monitoring the situation, don't get me wrong, but it's nothing unusual that we're going to have 4 to 5 to 5.5% problem banks in good times. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, but those continue to get our attention. We talked briefly, and then on page 65, when the bottom box down there shows that they're meeting the guidelines of conducting exams when due. Right now, you can see Bank and Trust, when we look at just ours, it's 96% when we count in the joint exams. Because of scheduling with the federal agencies, it's at 90%, which still is not bad at 90%, The rest of them were 100, but, you know, we're critical on the personnel. We lose too many more people. You know, we could go below the 100 on the, and IT and trust actually are short one, and we need to look at trying to fill those vacancies up as soon as we can. And then the commercial side, if we had anybody coming in on our conversions, they always disrupt the process as far as we've got to go back and look at the schedule and add something in that we didn't think about before. So it's tight, and we'll look at that carefully. On page 66, really under the division highlights are the hot buttons. In the oil and gas, which we continue to look at, we've got 25 institutions that we request supplemental information on a quarterly basis. And we don't see any dramatic deterioration from the numbers that are coming in, and then we follow that up on our on-site exams of looking at it. I will say of the two banks that weren't problems that are now problems, the two new ones are oil and gas related. One was kind of heavy into the hotel loans that primarily were located in communities, and so there's a lot of hotels are having to close up shop, and the reduced occupancy has hurt the cash flow. And the other one was strictly lending to service companies, primarily, very little expiration, and the slow times kind of caught up with some of their borrowers. None of it really serious. I think they'll be able to work out of it, but their classified assets did go up. So, and that, from looking at the survey and seeing the numbers come in, we kind of expected some of that when we went into them during the exam. Commercial real estate is still an item that we look at. You know, Charles has mentioned it several times, but Texas banks, you know, that's kind of bread and butter lending is commercial real estate. And so we don't want to get too excited that, you know, the world's coming to an end. We understand there's a concentration. We understand that the risk that has to be monitored. So we are looking at it. There was a pilot program that the FDIC and CSBS and Kurt's area participated in, this pilot program, which is really kind of enhanced procedures during the exam to drill down and so to look at really how a bank is managing that risk. And so we participated in that, and we're going to go, it's going to go national, and we're going to continue the program for those banks that show high concentrations in commercial real estate. Won't be for every institution, but those that do have that elevated risk, doesn't mean the risk can't be managed, doesn't mean that it's bad or anything, just means it's there, and how's the bank managing and monitoring it. And then, not this time, but next meeting, there's some leadership training that we've got Kurt and regional director and some others into. They're in supervisory positions, and it's a little bit different because it's really been customized to our agency. We've had an individual that's worked, and it's over a period of 4 months, one day a month, basically, and then there's coaching sessions and projects in between. And so we think we'll know better next time to really report how the evaluation, but so far it looks pretty promising as being a very useful tool to help a lot of people in the leadership area as they're coming up through the ranks. Any questions on bank and trust? If not, 68 starts the memo with our corporate area. Activity is a little bit lower. I will say that some of the bank applications they received have been a little bit more complex than normal as far as what the, you know, a different type of subsidiary. We've had a couple of banks talk to us about possible conversions, so they've been working on that. And then on page 69, the second bullet point, there's the activity there that's happened with the banks. Texas Regional Bank Harlingen acquired the Blanco National, and Blanco National was a $183 million institution. We lost one. State Bank of Texas Houston was merged into Post Oak Bank, which is a national association. They were $166 million. And then recently we had a pretty good merger between Independent Bank McKinney bought North Star, both of them state charters, and so the total now for that institution is $7.4 billion. Independent Bank McKinney was a survivor of that one.
Hey, Bob, have you seen any new bank charter activity? I know how the FDIC had an outreach program, what, about a month ago or so?
We get, there's some tire kicking, you know, but I'll be honest with you. Some of the people kicking the tire think it's 20 years ago and that $5 or $7 million is enough to start a bank, and it's not today, you know, especially if you want to do it in the metropolitan area. And so coming up to reality, you know, we've got one application now of a new bank in Austin that is progressing along. So, but some discussion, but nothing really serious. I think probably we've had more potential buyers are looking at some of the small rural banks that they could buy and then move into a metropolitan area.
Did you guys join in on the FDIC's outreach? Because, I mean, yes. Obviously, okay, so yes. You were there, so yes. It was kind of...
Yes, yeah. Dan okay. Frazier went up there, and Mark Mavon also largely worked with them.
Okay, good.
What about the number of branches that the state banks have? Are they expanding?
You know, I need to get that number. Dan and Mark, neither one of them are here today, I apologize. We haven't seen a lot of closures. There's some closures, but I don't think it's a lot. I'll get that number while we report it next time on kind of what it was over the last couple of years. We're seeing a net increase or decrease in branches.
Well, that's something that we had talked about in terms of bank branch closures along the U.S.-Mexico border, and that's been significant. And that as a result of the Durbin Amendment on Dodd-Frank, in 2010, there's been a tremendous number of branch closures, but we'll have to. I'll defer to that research to see what the total number of branches are. In my opinion, are decreasing, but I'll defer to you to get the actual numbers.
I just feel like I see in my market that the independent banks. Again, I can't. I don't necessarily know if they're state or national, but I see new branches opening. But they could be national banks.
Yeah. Well, I will say some of the very large national Citicorp, Wells, I haven't heard so much of Wells, but, you know, Citicorp and I think Bank of America, they've sold off a lot of branches, rural branches in Texas, right. You know. And so there's been some consolidation because whoever buys them may not need all of them. They'll have to buy them all, but then they get a good deal on it, you know, so they'll consolidate. They may have something close that they just, you know, merge the two branches that they have, but they wanted to gain some market share on the deal. So the numbers are going to be down. You're right, Hector. The overall numbers are going to be down. But let me pull it and try to look at the numbers from size of the institution and how that's the movement is.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
All right, then I'll finish up for the banking department. There were legislatively, there were four bills that we were helped work on, and on the Senate side, it's very easy. Our numbers are 1400 through 1403, so it's very, very easy to follow those. Three of them have passed out of the Senate and been referred to the House. One of them has been voted out of the committee and is on the Senate local and consent calendar for next week. So that side is moving very well, and on the House side, they're all out of the committee, and they all have been recommended for the local and uncontested calendar. So we think we're in great shape on both sides on those. The other bill that we've worked, put a tremendous amount of work on, the comptroller asked us to help with their bullion depository bill, and it is not a state-run depository. It's going to be run by a company that the state signs a contract with, where you can actually place your own bullion and other kind of metals and precious gems at, and it is set up that we will license the companies called depository agents that will take your gold and then get it to the depository, or will take your money and make sure that gold is bought for you on behalf of the depository. It's just been a ton of work, and we're hoping we're close to the finish line on that. On page 70 is Russell Reese's the special ed's report. Examinations are on track. I think yesterday, I'm not sure if you look at your finance commission email addresses very often, but we issued a consumer alert yesterday for a company in Sulphur Springs called Ask Apple Casket Company. we have determined that he sold contracts without a license. This one gets a little bit more hairy because Mr. Bankston, who owned the company, died. We have tried to file a claim with the probate court. Our claim was denied. And so we're working with the individuals now to see if there's anything else we can do to try to help them get their money back. They cannot make a claim to the guarantee fund because it was an unlicensed seller, and the guarantee fund is only available for licensed permit holders. So that's something we're working on. Also, we sent y'all links to our Rate the Department surveys that we got, and we got a really small rate of return in the specialized area. It was about 12%, but they were all positive. But the one thing that we saw frequently in that was, can you please provide more on the ground training? Like, what's the basic? How do you fill out this form? How do you do this reconciliation? And so we have committed to start doing a webinar at least once a quarter, where we really are taking it back down to the basics of how you fill out a prepaid funeral contract or how you do your record keeping. And next week, one of our examiners and myself are going to be at the Texas Cemetery Association Conference, and we're going to do one of those presentations there. And then we're going to go to webinars thereafter.
Stephanie, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Back to the comment that you made on the unlicensed activity and the guarantee fund not being able to pay a claim for that. Is that statutory?
Yes.
Okay.
And then on page 73, our performance measures, we met or exceeded all of our performance measures, so we're very happy with that. In Wendy's memo, the thing I wanted to point out, it's strange because Leslie talked about it too, but it just stands out so much. On page 78, it's our website hits, and Wendy and her group do so much work to try to make sure that our website looks good and has all the information that people need and that it's easy to access. They just spend so much time looking at it and redeveloping it and changing it. But our website for the period September 1st through February 28th had the views of 335,000 pages were reviewed. So, I mean, that just seems amazing, amazing to me. And then the Finance Commission, y'all had 15,299, so there you go.
So I have a request there.
Yes.
I would also like to know, for the people that don't have a life, who is watching our meetings.
It's not very many.
But I would like that to be reported.
Okay.
A lot of it's staff.
Yeah, a lot of it is staff.
I just want to know the number.
Okay.
Excluding family members or?
Just want to know.
Staff, yeah.
We'll exclude staff. We'll leave family members. And that's all I have on those. And if you don't have any other questions on our memos, I'll turn it over to Debbie Loomis because Catherine's not here today either. And Debbie's going to go over the legal report.
Call out, celebrate the St. Joseph's.
Yeah.
The Battle of St. Joseph's.
It was 420 celebration, marijuana. I didn't get involved.
I didn't know anything about that. That's somebody talking about.
Good morning. Debbie Loomis, Deputy General Counsel, Texas Department of Banking. The report is on pages 79 through 80, and the only thing I want to bring to your attention that's changed since the report came out is in regard to the first item, the case against Myrtlewood Memorial Services. The judge did sign the final order on April 12th. This is a case where we had a cemetery that failed to renew, and you have to have a certificate of authority to keep on being a perpetual care cemetery. So the Attorney General sued on our behalf, and the corporation will be dissolved, and the cemetery will no longer be perpetual care. It's still operating, and we asked the court, and all the parties agreed, that the perpetual care fund will move from being a trust fund into a certificate of deposit, and the principal will remain intact, and the income will automatically go to the cemetery to care for the cemetery, but there's no change that can be made to the CD, and there's no amount that can be taken from principal unless there's the signature of both the cemetery owner and a representative of the Department of Banking. Previously, all the income was being taken up by trustee fees, so this seemed to be the best solution for all. So we're glad to have that finally resolved. And Ms. Newberg discussed the Apple Casket case, so I don't need to update you on that. So unless you have any questions on anything else, the report's there.
Thank you.
Thanks, Debbie. And that's all we have.
Thank you. Savings and mortgage lending.
Okay. Savings and mortgage lending begins on page 81, but before I start on thrift, I want to inform you about a mortgage servicer issue that you may have seen in the national press yesterday. And I'll tell you generally what about it and then tell you what SML's role in this has been. But it's Aquin Loan Servicing, LLC. You may have seen, as I said, something about it on the news or in the paper. Yesterday, about 27 states filed enforcement actions against Aquin, including Texas SML. And I'll just describe ours briefly in a few moments. Aquin is one of the largest non-depository mortgage servicers in the country. They, in Texas, there are 100,000 Texas residents whose loans are being serviced by Aquin. The corporate headquarters is in West Palm Beach, Florida. In Texas, they have locations in Addison and Houston, with Addison being the larger. The state regulators, in a coordinated effort, issued various cease and desist and other enforcement actions yesterday, alleging systemic issues around the country relating to accurate reconciling of consumers' mortgage escrow accounts, operating unlicensed mortgage servicing facilities, and concerns about Aquin's ability to be financially, to sustain itself financially. SML's order, in particular, issues prohibits the company from acquiring any new mortgage servicing rights or acquiring new origination, originating new mortgage loans, until they can exhibit that they are a going concern by providing a financial analysis, and until they can provide a third-party audit of their escrow account showing that consumer funds are being appropriately managed. They have 30 days to appeal the order, so that is not a final order. Additionally, yesterday, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau filed a lawsuit based on similar concerns, and a New York securities firm is conducting an investigation from the securities aspect based on activities reported along these same lines. There are several SML folks here who have been involved in this. We're happy to answer any questions to the extent that we can, considering that it is potential litigation.
What's the effect on consumers?
At this point, consumers should continue sending their payments to Aquin. Aquin is still operating until they receive notification from Aquin that their mortgage servicing has been transferred elsewhere. So at this point for consumers, it's continuing what they're doing today.
Assume for a second, hypothetically, that company were to go out of business or contract substantially. Are there sufficient other large servicers who could fill the need without having a significant hiccup in the
business? That is one of the areas that the states are coordinating on. And Tony, do you have anything else you'd want to say on that? Tony Florence is our director of mortgage exam and licensing. So that is something that we have been discussing across the states as a whole.
But for the consumer, what would be at risk is their escrow account.
Yes.
Is there a concern that monies are missing from the escrows or just poor accounting? Don't know.
I'm trying to not to make sure what I can actually say. Our CND alleges that there have been mismanagement in the escrow accounts. I don't know for a fact whether monies are missing or not.
I can speak as the mortgage industry member, for it has been common knowledge, and I'm not saying this in a way to malign them, but they are known in the industry as a problematic entity, and I regularly receive complaints from consumers on how things have been handled at Aquin. So it's very frustrating to those of us that are here following all of the rules and the laws. I would imagine servicing would be transferred to another entity should they not continue to exist. But Aquin collects payments and manages escrows and had a position in the marketplace, especially in the subprime universe, where they serviced a very large component of subprime non-performing loans. So it's been a problematic entity for a long time, and there's been much press about this, not the legal action,
correct,
but them in general.
So, Stacy, help me understand, for those of us not in the industry, how it is that they acquire the portfolio that they service.
So servicing is bought and sold, just like you see in the student loan business is probably the most common analogy. Navient is the number one student loan servicer. You go get a student loan and everybody ends up at Navient because they seem to buy the servicing. It's the same with mortgages. You know, it's a commodity. We make and close a loan, and then as a lender, it's often transferred to a servicer who then sells it for revenue. And so that's how Auckland's positioned in the marketplace. My understanding was they were not an originator. They were just a servicer.
That's correct.
That's my understanding.
They do some originations.
Yeah. So yeah. That I was not aware
recapture
of.
Recapture and stuff like
yeah.
that, I'm sure.
Yeah. They do loan modifications. I mean, they do things like that. But I didn't think they were doing new originations.
So my biggest concern for Texas would be, are we getting, are we having them make restitution? So in other words, is part of your consent order, I don't know if you can say it, that they would set up a fund where they would put money? Because as you say, their going concern mm-hmm. is questionable, right? So what are we doing to try to get in front of that to make sure that we have money to make restitution to Texas?
He left.
That was it. He didn't want to comment.
Yeah, so the consent order does not include any administrative penalties or fines, nor does it include restitution at this point.
And because I don't want to speak out of term, but they are we do regulate them.
Correct.
So would a recovery fund, how would the recovery fund play into such a damage? It would not. Okay, thank you.
Got it.
Okay. And I'm thinking back to the state of California, I want to say about a year ago, they got their chunk of change out of Auckland, right, in order to pay back the California borrowers that, you know, they had issues with. So it would be good if we think ahead of like that to be able to be one of those to get in there before anybody else gets
and,
their
and
share.
What we can do and currently are doing is, well, let me back up. We have designated certain staff to be the ones to whom any of these calls go to. And part of that script for them will be to find out if they have a specific complaint we can help them with in terms of getting any funds. And what we have found is, as I tell y'all every meeting, we've got 1,100 complaints over the last year, 60% are mortgage servicing, 192 of those last year were Auckland, and about 35% were literally escrow issues. Mm-hmm. So what we do, what we find is when we send the copy of the complaint, very frequently the respondent goes ahead at that point and makes and satisfies the customer with what funds are being sought. Mm-hmm. In terms of a coordinated effort I think you're saying about from the larger pot, how will that work? At this point, that I don't know how that has not been totally determined at this point. But it is something that we're definitely aware of, the states we're talking about, because that's the number one issue is how do we protect that consumer? Right. First is we want them to keep making those payments, because if not, they're going to fall behind, and they could end up with foreclosure, and exacerbates a situation that's already difficult. Right. And then secondly is exactly your question. If it is no longer a going concern, how can we protect them financially in terms of if they are owed money, if their escrow accounts are not being managed properly, what do we do then? And so that is some of that continuing discussion and how to do that nationwide with these all
is
the states.
Is the company publicly traded?
Yes,
it is.
And the good thing is this is a coordinated effort with multi-states,
and
at least they're not all, you know, acting on their own accord. So
yes.
To me, I would think that will bring a better outcome.
Yes, and the coordination has been going on for the last couple of years. This has not happened overnight. We've been discussing as a coordinated group for quite some time. So,
What gives us the insight to believe it might not be a going concern? Are they having auditor problems or what?
Because there was a multi-state examination that examined books and records.
It's been in the
and
news.
I can't discuss the results of that. But
that's why I was trying to tease out the public, because you know obviously if your auditor says, you know, they're not going to sign the audit letter, then that would be a hint, right? So
and they keep getting hit with so like California hit them with a bunch of fines. Mm-hmm. number of years ago, I would assume all the other states are going to hit them with penalties and fines and.
And the CFPB.
CFPB has hit them and.
They're under an order with the CFPB. The CFPB's lawsuit doesn't seek a specific amount of damages, but it does seek, it does provide for administrative penalties, I believe restitution.
It seeks for redress.
It's a broad prayer for relief.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a difference between going bankrupt and, you know, going out of business because you can't.
Correct.
Be a going concern. So I was just trying to get my head around how we reach the conclusion for reaching.
And did I hear you correctly? Did you say 100,000 Texas loans are serviced there?
Correct.
Okay, well, I'm pleased that number is as low as it is.
Yes, exactly.
That is a very low number for what I would have expected it to be.
Right. They're one of the largest in Texas, but it's about 100,000.
Yeah. There has been rumors going around about them for a long time. So I guess when I said my concern about the going concern was more from nothing known of fact other than everything that I've been reading in the press for like years on them. So,
yeah, those of you in the industry will be able to evaluate this pretty accurately.
And the complaints that we get, I mean, I hear from people often, especially for servicing. That just seems to be the number one thing people like to call about. It's not necessarily a loss of money. It could be they didn't pay their tax bill in the end of the year, and so they lost the tax deduction, and they had a penalty, and who's paying the late penalty when the money was in escrow, and it was the servicer's responsibility, not the consumer. They paid 1/12 every month with their mortgage payment.
Yeah.
Or the insurance didn't get renewed, and then they got force-placed, five-time insurance cost put on there. So it's practices. Not necessarily loss of money in addition to.
So we'll continue to update you all on both SML's portion and in the general area of the CFPB lawsuit, et cetera. Then on page 82, the thrift area, savings banks continue to be well rated. The non-performing assets decreased slightly, but are now at 0.28% of total assets. The items that we continue to, or some of the specific items we continue to monitor, are long-term asset exposure, concentrations, and liquidity risks. And I mentioned these the last couple of meetings as well, so I'm going to be brief on those. But what we're finding with those particular items is when we look at the outliers, which is what we focus on, is they're operating within their own historical norms, such as in the case of those who have high long-term asset exposure. We've gone back and studied, and they've had that same exposure for roughly 10 years. So they've proved to us that they know what they are doing, and they're doing it well. That doesn't mean that we're not paying maybe some specific attention to it, but there is some backup there to let us know that they're managing that well. Or we have some with a concentration in agricultural lending, but they are ag lenders. That is what they do. And again, they have shown us over a course of time that they know what they're doing and they're doing it well. And then the last example is with the liquidity risk. So far, we have found those savings banks who are outliers to be in a manageable situation. They do, when they're an outlier, get enhanced scrutiny at exams. They get, maybe if it's appropriate from a regulatory viewpoint, they may get some extra restrictions. They may get more frequent exams, and then they have more off-site supervision. So those are the tools we use to look at these various matters and see if there's a level of concern on our part. So, on page 85, charter and merger activity. You all have heard for quite some time that the landscape in the financial sector are mergers and acquisitions. And to date, in the savings bank industry in Texas, we've had mergers and acquisitions, but the savings bank has been the resulting institution or the acquirer. I've been reporting the Capital Bank merger out to be a national bank. The two holding companies are merging, and Capital Bank will be under the other holding company as a national bank. We have two more that I want to make sure you know about. One, we've received notice that Synergy Bank in McKinney is going to be acquired by a Louisiana state bank. And then First Bank Texas is converting from a savings bank to a national bank. in their family of banks, they already have a national bank, and they've been a national bank longer than they have the savings bank, so they are converting so that they'll be under the OCC.
Where is First Bank Texas headquarters?
It is in Bayard.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
Yep. It's in Bayard. So.
All I know is Mrs.
And are you getting any people interested in charters?
In the last 8 to 10 months, we've had two groups come to meet with us. Neither of them have really gotten any traction. One of them is still in communication with me, but we haven't seen any application. Both of those groups were mortgage groups who want to convert, who want to become a state savings bank. And which, of course, if they're mortgage groups, we regulate them already, so we know who they are, and which is helpful.
But then you have the FDIC
correct.
Issue.
So yeah. Far, the issue has been through the federal counterpart. Mm-hmm. I'm having various conversations with attorneys, particularly right now, who represent some mortgage groups that would like to become state savings banks, and developing some communication that I plan to have with the FDIC.
Yeah.
So. Then, and these three are in various stages of having their application be approved by the new regulator, so I don't know when they will really move out. So then moving on to the mortgage activity, the current licensing population is in the chart. I'm going to compare that for you with same time last year. So 3/31/16, the entity licensing population was 1,653. The branch population was 2,544. And individual MLOs was 20,671. As I said, I believe I said earlier, we just finished the renewal and reinstatement period the end of February, and I mentioned that 85% of those did renew, which is typical of what we've seen in years past. For the first half of 17, we've received 4,558 new applications, and that we see that continuing. On page 86, mortgage exams rough about the same in terms of ratings for the same time last year with regard to 1s, 2s, 3s, 4s, and 5s. So to date in 2017, we don't have any 5 rated mortgage companies. On page 87, at the top there is a typo. I apologize. The Mortgage Industry Advisory Committee meeting agenda is for the March 8th, 17 meeting, not October, and the agenda is there for you. With regard to our measures, we have met or exceeded all of our measures and expect that to continue throughout the year, I hope. On 88, on legislative activity, as you all will recall, there were several statutory recommendations that when members asked us if we had any, we made. Those are all in bills and are in various stages through the legislative process. We additionally were pulled into discussions on several other bills that did not come from our recommendations. We're continuing to work with several representatives and senators' offices as they draft their committee subs at this point. And you all get our weekly report, so you have, of course, we're monitoring a lot more than what's on the report, but you're seeing the highest priority on a regular basis. We had, on staffing, I told you about the postings. We had 3 terminations. One of our colleagues passed away in the last couple of months and is very much missed. One went to work for another state agency. It was not a financial regulatory agency. And then one left for personal family reasons. Regarding the legal activities referenced on page 89, by way of supplement, while there have been no contested SOA hearings since our last report to you, the department was notified Wednesday of this week that in the contested SOA case of the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending versus Sammy Trantham, that came out of a license denial, the SOA judge has granted the department's motion for summary disposition. So now the department prepares proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law for the judge's consideration as the judge prepares the proposal for decision. And that disposition affirms the department's denial of Mr. Trantham's license renewal request. That concludes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions about anything. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, at this time, the Finance Commission will enter. Oh, I guess I have to adjourn and then enter. Sorry. Do I have to adjourn and enter? Just go straight in. Okay. At this time, the Finance Commission will enter an executive session in accordance with applicable sections. Time is now 11:23, and we are back in open session. In accordance with Section 551.102 of the Open Meetings Act, no final action, decision, or vote on matters deliberated was made during executive session. Members, anything remaining? Okay, in that case, there being no further business, this meeting of the Finance Commission is now adjourned, and the time is now 11:25.
Good job.